It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
U.S. and Cuba move to normalize relations. U.N. Secretary General to visit Ebola-impacted countries of West Africa. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. In a dramatic policy change from a position held for more than 50 years, President Obama Wednesday announced Washington will move toward normalizing ties with Cuba and open an embassy on the communist-led island nation.
Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
Mr. Obama and his Cuban counterpart, Raul Castro, spoke by telephone for nearly an hour on Tuesday in what marked the first substantive presidential contact between the two countries since 1961. The move also came as Cuba released Alan Gross, an American contractor arrested in 2009 in Havana for bringing communications equipment to the island. The diplomatic shift followed more than a year of secret talks between the two longtime ideological foes involving Canada and Pope Francis. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is to visit the West African nation struggling the most with the Ebola epidemic. He says he'll visit Guinea, Liberia, Mali, and Sierra Leone, as well as Ghana, the site of the U.N. mission for the Ebola response. Mr. Ban said Wednesday he wants a first-hand look at the response and to show solidarity with those impacted by the illness.
But now is not the time to ease up on our efforts. As long as there is one case of Ebola, the risk remains. We must do everything we can to get to zero.
The UN chief said there's been an outpouring of life-saving contributions around the world, and the Ebola response strategy is working, but Ebola also continues to drive up food prices, keep children out of school, and stifle business activity. The World Health Organization says the death toll is now past 6,900. This is VOA News. Somali's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed has named a new prime minister amid international pressure to end chronic political infighting. He appointed Omar Abdirashid Ali Sharmarki to the post on Wednesday in a ceremony at the presidential palace in Mogadishu. Mr. Sharmarki, who must be approved by the parliament, would be Mr. Mohamed's third prime minister in the past 2 years. His predecessor, Abdiweli Sheikh Mohamed, was voted out December 6 after a dispute with the president over a cabinet reorganization. East African nations are bracing for even more South Sudanese refugees fleeing more than a year of conflict in their homeland unless peace is achieved soon. VOA's Gabe Joslow has the story in Nairobi.
Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Amina Mohamed, speaking to reporters after the launch of the refugee response plan in Nairobi, said Kenya continues to have faith in the process.
So at the political level, we're doing everything that we can. And I can tell you that we've made a lot of progress, but we're not there yet. We've made progress on all the issues except for issues that relate to security and the governance structure.
Kenya is part of the IGAD group of nations mediating the talks. The group has threatened sanctions against South Sudan leaders from both sides of the conflict if they cannot abide by a lasting ceasefire deal. Meantime, Kenya is also considering a new security bill that would, among other things, cap the number of refugees allowed in Kenya at 150,000. Kenya currently hosts more than 500,000 refugees, most of them from neighboring Somalia. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Parliament expected to vote on that measure today, also allowing police to hold suspects in terror-related cases for up to a year. Amendments would also open media outlets to fines for printing material deemed likely to cause fear or alarm. This follows more than a year of attacks by Somali-based al-Shabaab militants. Rights groups warn the changes will curb fundamental freedoms. Zambia's acting President Guy Scott rejecting all call by cabinet ministers to step down ahead of a presidential election next month. He said there is no provision in the Constitution for such a demand. The acting president said he'll stay in power until the election is held January 20th. Mr. Scott ineligible to run because his parents were not born in Zambia. He became Africa's first white head of state in 20 years in October when President Michael Sata died. In sports, a pathologist from Cameroon said the death of Cameroonian footballer Albert Ebos in Algeria in August was caused by a brutal post-match beating, not a thrown object by angry fans following his team's 2-1 loss. Meanwhile, Kenyan rugby has been thrown into turmoil after the Kenyan Rugby Union chairman, Mwangi Muthi, resigned Wednesday following the poor showing by the Sevens team in the Sevens World Series. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington, sitting in for the vacation, James Batty. Today is Thursday, December 18th. Here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Kenyan lawmakers express opposition to a newly proposed bill aimed to strengthen anti-terrorism laws.
What do they want to strengthen? Which part of the law has failed to work?
Terrorism does not supersede our constitution.
Jakoyo Midiwo is Kenya's National Assembly Deputy Minority Leader. Faced with an ongoing war, South Sudan's government announces plans to reconstruct the country's busiest roads. And cabinet ministers in Zambia want acting President Guy Scott to step down and hand over power.
First of all, they apologized to the people of Zambia for having placed or misplaced their trust in Honorable Guy Scott.
That's Joseph Katema, the Zambian Information Minister. Zimbabwe's former finance minister says he is not impressed with President Robert Mugabe's latest government reshuffle. We'll have details, and we will have a report about the Ebola outbreak in the three West African countries battling the disease. Those stories, plus Marco Ume's sport and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A group of Kenyan parliamentarians has voiced strong opposition to an anti-terrorism measure that supporters say will strengthen the government's effort to combat terrorism. Lawmakers are expected to debate the proposal ahead of a vote today, Thursday. National Assembly Deputy Minority Leader Jakoyo Midiwu says opponents of the anti-terror bill will ensure it fails. He told me that there is no need for the measure because there is an existing anti-terrorism law which the administration has refused to enforce. Jakoyo Midiwo is Kenya's National Assembly Deputy Minority Leader. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi.
It's in public domain that the government is trying to bring some draconian law. I don't think they are anti-terror law. Kenya already has an anti-terror law, which has not been enforced since we passed it. This is just a bad law that takes us back to the dark days of KANU, to be precise.
So you will oppose this?
Yes, it is. We will oppose it in a concord. We will be opposing it tomorrow, and it's coming up for debate tomorrow morning.
Honorable Midiwo, the government is saying that they want to strengthen anti-terror laws because of the attacks recently launched by armed groups, including Al-Shabaab. Supporters of the measure are saying that failure to support it basically is siding with the enemy. What do you say to that?
Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, what do you want to see? What do they want to strengthen? Which part of the law has failed to work? Even if the government wanted to strengthen some law, the bottom line is the law is unconstitutional. You know, terrorism does not supersede our constitution. It doesn't happen anywhere. It doesn't happen anywhere where people behave lawfully. We want the government to use the existing laws, which they have refused to use, reform the police. That's precisely where the problem is. And quite frankly, I think the government is trying to militarize the country.
Will you have enough support on your side to derail this measure?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. We have lobbied enough. I think we will have enough support. If they don't, if common sense does not prevail, I think we will see how it goes. But I think it is now explained to the country what Kenyatta is trying to do.
You made mention of militarization of the security agencies. What do you mean by that?
I mean, the head of intelligence is from the military. The army chief of staff, the general chief of staff, rather, is overly political. You then want to see a trend which everybody is now saying the next person to be appointed, which is the police inspector. There are a few names of the generals being dropped in. The cabinet secretary that they are choosing now is a former army general. I mean, if that's not militarization, I don't know what is.
On the floor of Parliament Thursday, will your supporters demand that a government enforce anti-terror laws already on the books? Is that what you're looking at here, and do you think they will follow it?
That is what we have been doing publicly, and that's what we are going to do tomorrow.
Jakoyo Midiwo is Kenya's National Assembly Deputy Minority Leader. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. Zambia's cabinet ministers have demanded that acting President Guy Scott step down from office a day after they approved a vote of no confidence against him, according to Information Minister Joseph Katema. 14 ministers present at the meeting agreed to Scott's removal from office after accusing him of failure to support the candidate of the ruling Patriotic Front, or PF, and thwarting the group's effort to win next month's presidential by-election. Katema told me that the cabinet ministers were united in their decision to vote against Mr. Scott, to as well as his role as acting leader of the governing PF.
The members of cabinet did discuss and agree that they pass a vote of no confidence in the acting president, Guy Scott. First of all, they apologized to the people of Zambia for having placed or misplaced their trust in Honorable Dr. Guy Scott and put him as a acting president of the Republic of Zambia, that he has breached the trust of first the Patriotic Front as a party and the government of the Republic of Zambia, the people of Zambia, because it is evident that every move he takes is entailing a risk to the security and the peace of this nation.
Wouldn't this plunge the government into crisis, since the infighting or the alleged infighting in the Patriotic Front appear to have spilled over into government activities, in this case forcing the president or acting president to resign after ministers unanimously voted?
There is actually no infighting if you look at it very closely. There's only one Guy Scott fighting his party, the Patriotic Front. He asked for a Congress. When the Patriotic Front requested to, the Central Committee of the Patriotic Front requested to cut on time and choose, using a provision of their constitution, to choose a candidate for themselves. That is when the secretary, the chairperson of the Patriotic Front, Honorable Inongewina, who by our constitution is the convener of the Congress, of the National Congress, declared the presidency vacant as the constitution of the Patriotic Front, and these elections started.
When do cabinet ministers expect the acting president to resign, or who takes over from him?
That shall be advised by the lawyers. It will be advised. That is not the only thing that he has breached. At every corner, he tries to frustrate. He has even banned all the Patriotic Front cabinet members not to travel outside or inside the country. How does his party campaign if he has told no member of cabinet, member of cabinet minister or deputy minister, they should go out of Lusaka?
Joseph Katema is Zambia's information minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. South Sudan's government says it will launch a reconstruction project on one of the country's busiest transportation networks, the Juba-Yei-Kaya Road. Officials believe this road, which connects the country to East Africa via Uganda, will greatly improve South Sudan's economic prospects. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
South Sudan Minister of Transport, Roads and Bridges Kwang Danher Gatluak says the road project will cost about $514 million.
Studies after studies have been carried out for the last 5 years, and we were planning as a ministry and as a government looking for funding and the opportunity when it would be the right time to build that road. And we are in advanced stage with the Minister of Finance trying to negotiate and to see the terms of the loan agreement. And as soon as the Minister of Finance is through with the loan agreement, we'll commence the work.
The Juba-Yei-Kaya Road starts in the capital and passes through Lanya and Yei, ending in Morobo County at Kaya at the border with Uganda. Before the completion of the current lifeline Juba-Nimule Highway, the road was the main thoroughfare connecting South Sudan's capital Juba to East Africa. The road has an important historical significance. During the decades of civil war fought between Juba and Khartoum, millions of South Sudanese fled to Uganda via the Juba-Yei-Kaya Road. Member of Parliament Thomas Wanikundo, who represents Lainya County, sets some light on the road's history.
The SPLA broke the backbone of Jalaba through the A Road by a swift and then a heavy victory caused on Jalaba in 1997 from Kaya out to Bridge 40. It was through the A Road. The second thing is the SPLA entered Juba in 2005 through A Road.
Jalaba was a derogatory term used by then South Sudanese fighters against the Khartoum regime to refer to their Arab enemies. Jimmy Wongo, Minister of Physical Infrastructure for Central Equatoria State, says reconstructing the road should improve life for many local residents as well as boost the agricultural sector.
The road is going to remove the challenges of transporting food from the neighboring countries. Areas like Lanya, Yei, and Kaya are very productive areas, and therefore the produce will find its way to the markets of Juba, and also transporting people and any other things this way.
Yei and Morobo are some of the leading agricultural food producing counties in Central Equatoria State. Wongo says in the past, lack of stable roads has meant farmers had no way of transporting their fruits and vegetables to Juba markets. Gatluak says if Parliament approves the loan as expected, work on the road should begin early next year. For VOA News, I am Waka Simon Wudu from Juba.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 18th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Ahead on our program, Mark Omer Sport and our listener of the day. Zimbabwe's former finance minister Tendai Biti says he has no faith in the new-look ZANU-PF team unveiled last week and their capacity to pull Zimbabwe out of its political, economic and social crisis. Biti, who is currently in Washington, D.C. as a visiting fellow at the Center for Global Development, says Zimbabweans need to start looking to the youth for their salvation. VOA Studio 7 reporter Blessing Zulu has more.
Biti told a meeting here yesterday that the recent reshuffle of positions both in the ruling ZANU-PF and cabinet was a non-event, adding Zimbabweans must look to the youth for a change in the nation's trajectory. President Robert Mugabe last week fired Vice President Joyce Mujuru and replaced her with Emmerson Mnangagwa. The former finance minister, who is one of the leaders of the United Movement for Democratic Change, took a swipe at Mr. Mugabe, saying he's displaying dictatorial tendencies like some former late African dictators.
One of Africa's greatest failures has been the fact that we have put so much faith in what I can describe as little big men. They're big men, all right. Mobutu Sese Seko was a very big man within the context of Zaire. Robert Mugabe is a very big man. Siad Barre is a very big man. Wofet Bwinyi is a very big man. I can go on and on and on and on. But these big men are very little when it comes to the question of sustainable vision.
On the government of national unity, Biti said its major achievement was bringing Zimbabweans to work together as a team. Despite policy inconsistencies in Zimbabwe, Biti says investors can do business with Harare, but not on a short-term basis. Responding to the issue of sanctions imposed on Harare, Biti said the stick-and-carrot approach must be used to entice reforms. On why Zimbabwe was on the agenda of the Center for Global Development, the center's chief operating officer and senior fellow, Todd Moss, said Zimbabwe is an important nation for the world to ignore.
We've taken a long interest in Zim as a very promising country that unfortunately has become a fragile state in many respects. The country's had the worst economic collapse in modern times outside of a war. And just at a time when African economies are booming, the Africa Rising narrative is becoming more common. Zimbabwe actually experienced 11 years in a row of shrinking economy. And, of course, Zimbabwe's had a very difficult, tense relationship with this town. and with the Western world more generally.
In 2001, the United States began imposing targeted sanctions on the government of Zimbabwe, including restrictions on U.S. support for multilateral financing, financial sanctions against selected individuals and entities, travel sanctions against selected individuals, a ban on transfers of defense items and services, and a suspension of non-humanitarian government-to-government assistance, citing rights abuses and rigged elections. Despite strained political relations between Washington and Harare, the United States is a leading provider of humanitarian assistance to the people of Zimbabwe through food and other necessities. This is Blessing Zulu in Washington, D.C.
And you heard the word unprecedented a lot this year to describe the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. It has killed more than 6,800 people and infected nearly three times as many. All this after the virus spent decades in isolated forests on the other side of the continent, popping up intermittently and killing a few hundred people at a time at most. But in West Africa, Ebola crossed borders and reached cities, sparking global alarm. The epidemic is still not under control. Viewers and Luke takes a look back on Ebola in 2014.
Getting your temperature taken has become the norm at airports and border crossings around West Africa this year. Fever is one of the first symptoms of Ebola. In the three hardest hit countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, people try not to shake hands or hug. You are not supposed to care for your sick or bury your dead as before. The bodily fluids of Ebola patients and victims spread the disease. The regional epidemic is not under control, not even in southeastern Guinea, where it began in December 2013. Months passed before the virus was identified. Ebola spread to the capital, Conakry, and then crossed into Sierra Leone and Liberia. Cases began to surge in those two countries in June. Ebola was new to West Africa. There was confusion, miscommunication, and fear. Some people resisted treatment and safe burials. People in a Monrovia suburb rioted. Governments responded with what they called shock therapies, like area lockdowns and quarantines. They increased education efforts. Billboards went up. Ebola is real, they said. Health workers walked the streets, teaching people about the symptoms. They continue to go door to door, looking for possible cases.
Know as to whether you have any sick person, somebody suffering from malaria, fever, typhoid, pressure.
To stop the spread of Ebola, the sick must be isolated and treated by trained staff wearing head-to-toe protective gear. Those who die from Ebola must be buried by special crews. But response efforts couldn't keep up. Ebola had laid bare these countries' already inadequate health systems, and then it crippled them even further. Sierra Leone's health minister, Dr. Abubakar Fofana.
I can probably count with my fingers the number of ambulances that we had when the outbreak was declared. And for a population of 6 million people in a terrain as difficult as the one that we had.
By September in Monrovia, the number of cases was doubling every 3 weeks. Regular hospitals were closed. There weren't enough beds or staff at Ebola treatment units. Jackson Nyama, a Liberian medic working for Doctors Without Borders, addressed the UN Security Council by teleconference.
We have to turn people away, and they are dying at our front gate. Right now, as I speak, there are patients sitting at our front gate, literally begging for lives. If the international community does not stand up, we will be wiped out.
The UN launched a regional Ebola mission. The United States sent 3,000 troops to build Ebola treatment units in Liberia. October was the start of a massive scale-up in international response that continues into 2015. Experts say there are still months of work ahead. About half of those killed by Ebola this year were in Liberia. Most of the rest were in Guinea and Sierra Leone. In all, eight countries on three continents reported cases. It was, as people kept saying, unprecedented. Those killed included some 350 health workers in West Africa. Sierra Leone lost three doctors in the first half of December alone. But there were some victories. About 40% of those infected this year who received medical care survived. Senegal and Nigeria acted fast and contained small outbreaks in their countries. And the sheer scale of the regional epidemic jump-started stalled research efforts into Ebola worldwide. Trials for vaccines and possible drug treatments are underway and have raised hope for an effective response to Ebola sometime in the near future. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sport. Here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the FIFA Club World Cup in Marrakech, Morocco. Algeria's Orange Africa Champions League title holders and tentative salvaged a measure of pride for Africa when they clinched fifth spot at the FIFA Club World Cup on Wednesday. And tentative required a penalty shootout to edge Australia's Western Sydney Wanderers 5-4 in the fifth place playoff. The two sides were deadlocked at two goals apiece at the end of open play. Staying in Marrakech, Argentina's San Lorenzo pipped New Zealand's Auckland City 2-1 in extra time in the second semi-final at the FIFA Club World Cup on Wednesday. In Sudan, former Ghana national team coach Kwesi Appiah has signed a two-year contract to coach Sudan's Khartoum Al-Watani FC. This is Appiah's first coaching assignment outside Ghana. He is set to guide the club in their 2015 Orange Africa Confederations Cup campaign. Meanwhile, Kenyan John Mwaura is the new coach for Somalia's Mogadishu-based Premier League champions, Banadir Sports Club. The club chairman, Abukar Mohamed Sheikh, revealed in Nairobi, Kenya. Mwaura is the first foreign coach in Somalia in 30 years. Turning to basketball, Angolan defending champions Primero de Agosto tackled Tunisia's Club Africains in quarterfinals at the Africa Men's Club Basketball Championships in the Tunisian capital Tunis today, Thursday. In other quarterfinals, the Mayotte Islands Mtapere challenged Tunisia. AES Rades, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Mazembe engage Angola's Libolo, while Tunisia's U.S. Monastir is up against Egypt's Sporting Alexandria. Finally, the East African University Games enters its second day at the Uganda Christian University in Mukono, some 30 kilometers east of the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Over 4,000 sportsmen and women from 45 universities in Burundi, Rwanda, Kenya, Tanzania and Uganda are vying for honors in athletics, badminton, basketball, chess, football, handball, hockey, karate, netball, rugby, scrabble, swimming, taekwondo, table tennis, volleyball and woodball. Uganda's Ndeje University are the game's defending champions. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Peter, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Thursday morning, December 18th.
I wish to call on the PDP-led government. As a matter of urgency, to find a lasting solution to this waste scarcity going on. The scarcity has hit a lot of many things. The price of goods in the market during this facility period has risen by 100%. A country like ours, an oil producing country, workers have decided to sabotage the festivity by going on strike, the oil workers. What a terrible situation in this part of the continent. Comrade Mars Patrick Okorokra for Overblow Premises, Atane Amchuku in Abia State, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's it for this Thursday, December 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Ricky Shryock, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, I'm Peter Clotte in Washington wishing you a good Thursday.
Hello,
sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.